Session number 11105, Colonel M. McBain, Reel 3.
Colonel M. McBain, Reel 3. When did you go to Sandhurst, Colonel?
I'm trying to remember. I think almost certainly it would be autumn 1949. And we joined or became what was known at Sandhurst as Intake 6. It had started when Sandhurst reformed after the war. It was, of course, a combination of the pre-war Royal Military College and the Royal Military Academy. The Royal Military Academy having been at Woolwich, catering for gunners and sappers and the clever people, and the Royal Military College at Sandhurst for the infantry and the cavalry, basically. The post-war Sandhurst was the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst, RMAS, and that restarted, I think, probably around about 1947. And strangely enough, started with Intake 1. They then, to catch up with themselves, had Intake 1A, and then it went on from there, 2, 3, and I became part of Intake 6. And there must have been, I suppose, about 300 of us. The organisation at Sandhurst was into three colleges. There was old, and each college had four companies. There was Old College, New College, and Victory College. Old College, the four companies were, and I'm now going to have to struggle a bit, they were Peninsula War names, Salem, Waterloo, Inkerman, Salem, I can't honestly remember now, but they were that vintage. New College were the 1914-18 war names, Ypres, Somme, and so on. I was put into Victory College, which were the 1939-1949 battles, Alamein, Burma, Rhine. It is extraordinary how you forget these things. I was in Alamein Company. And I suppose Victory College was regarded as the junior college. I mean, there was no difference, really. We, as I say, were organised into the four companies in each college. Each company had a number of platoons, I suspect three. The uniform was battle dress, with white gorget patches on our collars. The RMA had its own cap badge, and we started off in 1949. We had khaki berets. We had special shirts. I say special. They were, I suspect, modelled on guards' officers' shirts. They were slightly strange colour with button-down collars, not button-down collars. The collars had two little tabs that used to connect up with a collar stud. You wore the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst flash on your each shoulder, which was red, yellow writing with red background. underneath that you had three bars, horizontal bars, in your college colour. The Victory College colour was yellow, New College was blue, and Old College was red. And from memory, you took one of those bars off for each term. So by the time you'd done your three terms, you were a senior, you had one bar left on your uniform. You wore leather belts, which inevitably had to be highly polished, and normally boots and gaiters. I think, yes, boots and gaiters. That was your uniform.
Were you given any items of equipment when you went there?
No, is the answer, as far as I can remember. No, I mean, you had, I think it was two suits of battle dress and various shirts and bits and bobs. The inevitable two pairs of boots. We had shoes, which obviously I suspect we wore in the evening.
When you arrived there, how were you actually received?
I honestly can't remember. I think any sort of joining like that, I mean, I can't remember in any detail how I was received at Fort George when I arrived there, other than the fact you're one of a great pile of bodies. But obviously it was all a fairly efficient organisation. And, of course, one met up. We'd been on leave between Warminster and Sandhurst for, I don't know, however long it was, 14 days. And, of course, the great excitement was meeting up with your friends again from wherever when you got to Sandhurst and trying to discover where everybody was, because it was a very big place for people there. Each intake was about 300. So there'd be 900 to 1,000 cadets there. And such was the state that, in fact, my junior term, was spent in Nissenhuts, a sort of annex at the back of the Victory College building, in Nissenhuts. Which was a bit of a surprise, however. There we were. They were all right. Most people were obviously in the old building, old college, or the new Sandhurst block, which of course gave its name to blocks of military barracks all over the country. I mean, Catterick and various other places. These blocks are still called Sandhurst blocks. It was just that style of architecture. So there we were in Alamein Company with cadets. Each cadet, obviously, was one cadet to a room. You had your own room, and they were reasonably furnished, even in the Nissenhuts. What was interesting, eventually in intermediate and senior terms, we moved into the building, the main building, and still at that stage, so it showed how much painting and decorating had been done. Over each room door was GC and a number, GC10. Well, that was Gentleman Cadet, which of course was a pre-war designation. We were known as Officer Cadets. Pre-war, they'd been known as gentlemen cadets. But the rooms still had GC over the door. Well, that was all right. And the other thing, of course, is that beside each bed, there was a bedside cabinet, which had a door in it, and you opened that door, and there was a bedside utensil, complete with royal cipher. This was 1949. However, that was all right. As I say, the rooms were basic furniture, obviously, were quite comfortable, and they were all heated and so on, so there was no great deprivation. And each company had its own anteroom, which took you on the first steps, I suppose, towards living in an officer's mess. And that was a sitting room, really, not used all that much, because quite honestly you didn't have much time, but it's where the newspapers were, magazines, and some reasonably comfortable chairs. The main function of the anteroom really was, it was where you assembled, either to be spoken to by the hierarchy, or more normally, it's where you assembled before dinner in the evening. You assembled in there and then processed from there along the long corridors as a company, and you picked up all the other companies on the way into the enormous dining room where you sat down and had dinner.
Were all meals taken in this dining room?
Yes, yes. I would try to pick up the daily routine. The first thing, and I honestly can't remember the time, I can't remember when it was, but the first parade was breakfast roll call. And when everyone in the place paraded, and you were inspected by the cadet NCOs and under officers. The hierarchy in each company had a senior under officer, and these were all in the senior term, senior under officer, and he had, and effectively he was the cadet company commander, three junior under officers, they were platoon commanders, and a cadet senior sergeant, who was the cadet sergeant major. That was the rank structure. And they were the people who took the roll call in the morning, and they were the people who did the inspections. And once that was over, into breakfast, I think. Having said that, I'm now wondering whether that was before or after breakfast. I think it was before breakfast. And then you push off and had breakfast. And then you went into the daily training routine, which was a mixture of classroom work, mainly military, and a tremendous amount of drill bashing around on the square. I think the whole time I was at Sandhurst, which 18 months, I think I was on the range three times in that time, so you know there was very little practical military work. A lot of PT, obviously. Driver training, you had to learn to drive, and you had to learn to ride motorbikes. That was all good value. And there was, yes, there was signal training as well, radio signal training. So very little range work, but quite a lot of driving, D&M as it was called, driving and maintenance. And that was very well organised, and I think probably one of the more popular things. That, of course, replaced pre-war, had been riding instruction, because part of the academy was an enormous great riding school, which was still actually as a riding school, because I decided I'd take up riding, so I in fact did learn to ride, but that was in my own time, wasn't part of the normal training. Then you had lunch, and then more of the, so there'd normally be sports in the afternoon of whatever it was, rugby, football, hockey, athletics, every known sport, really, because the facilities, of course, were excellent. And then tea. I've got a funny feeling we used to have a cup of tea or whatever it was in the anteroom. And then it was either more classroom work until just before dinner, and then dinner, and then a tremendous amount of cleaning equipment and boots and belts, and you know, polish ran riot, because basically the military, the major military interface was with the Brigade of Guards, the company, all the company sergeant majors were brigadier guards. The RSM was ex-brigadier guards. The adjutant and the assistant adjutant were always brigadier guards. But of course, company commanders, platoon commanders, and there were other NCOs, were from all the regiments and corps and so on in the army. There was a mixture, but the adjutant, assistant adjutant, and the sergeant, RSM and sergeant majors were all brigadier guards. And one had a tremendous amount of respect for most of them. They were all pretty good guys. And obviously, everyone really who was selected to go there on the staff of Sandhurst, with one or two exceptions, but normally they were pretty high-grade people. Of course, a lot of them, or a number of them, in 1949, had done very well during the Second World War, and there was a lot of experience there. But they'd all been hand-picked by whoever it was, by their own regiments or corps, to go to Sandhurst. And so you had a pretty high-powered bunch of military instructors.
What was the relationship, Colonel, between yourselves as trainee officers and these other ranks and NCOs who were part of your training team?
In fact, very good. Looking back on it now, in the sergeants, staff sergeants, colour sergeants and so on, they, and indeed the warrant officers, all, it was all part of the game, I suppose, to be trying to be fierce and so on. But in fact, thinking about it now, of course, they're very pleased to be there as instructors. They realised that it was a great step forward in their careers. And we all got on very well together. It was all part of the, I say, game. It didn't appear to be a game at the time, but again, with hindsight, it was all part. The great shout at Sandhurst was character building, building up your confidence and your leadership qualities and all the rest of it. That's why you were there. And the methods that were used, I think, by and large, were successful and proved themselves. And there was a lot of shouting and jumping up and down, particularly on the square, on drill parades and so on, because of course the drill instructors particularly were aiming to get us up to the standard of the Brigade of Guards, pre-war Brigade of Guards, and by and large we got there, and I would dare suggest we in fact overtook them. And the standard drill was extremely high, and a large ceremonial parade at Sandhurst was a very impressive sight. So, no, the relationship with the NCOs and warrant officers was very good. I mean, they knew what we were all going to be commissioned. We all respected them for their rank and their experience. They knew far more, obviously, about the army than we did. And so, no, it worked very well. And with the officer instructors, again, after the initial few months, I suppose, it was a very easy relationship with your class instructors and people who were teaching you various things. The instructional side was a mixture of civilian instructors and military instructors. Military history, for example, would be taught by civilians. Current affairs was taught by civilians. Obviously, military subjects were taught by army officers, who, as I've said, were all fairly experienced people, most of them having been in the Second World War, although obviously the younger ones probably just towards the end of it.
What form did your military theoretical training take in the sense of the Second World War coming in?
Yes, I mean, it was, of course, based entirely on the latter stages of the Second World War. And again, thinking about it, it was the training was used to make you think and get used to doing things and thinking in a military way, which had been proved during both wars, certainly the Second World War, and had been successful. Really, I suppose the essence would be to train you to think, react, and to respond to whatever was going on under all circumstances, whether you were tired or hungry or cold or whatever it was. You still had a job to do, and that was to command whatever it was you were commanding. And I think probably that was the basic aim of the training, the fact that you were learning how to maneuver divisions and brigades and cross the Rhine and do all sorts of things like that, which obviously you're never ever going to do, but it was just a method of training your brain, I suppose. Never having been to university, but I assume that people who take courses at university know full well they're not actually going to use the subject matter in their subsequent lives. It is just a matter of training your brain. And so, again, we were being trained physically to be fit and tough, and trained mentally to react to whatever was going on as we should. But in fact, you see, compared to nowadays, there was very little educational training. I mean, there was no question of us. Some did. Some cadets did go from Sandhurst to university. Whereas now, most of the cadets go from university to Sandhurst. It's the other way around. But in 1949, it was only the very, very clever ones who opted to go to university. Most didn't. And part of the entry qualifications were a higher school certificate or the Civil Service Commission exam, which meant you had achieved a certain level of scholastic achievement. But there wasn't much effort to improve that. You know, you didn't go on belting through physics. Trying now to think even whether languages took a place. I honestly can't remember whether we even did languages.
Mathematics? Did you do some form of mathematics?
Only as part of any military training, you know. If you had to work out how many guns were going to fire, how much ammunition in whatever time. Was there any sort of science facility? I don't think. No, the training was, thinking about it, you know, it was geared to a purpose, which was fine. It was to produce a second lieutenant for whatever organisation he wanted to go into. And everything was geared to that.
Commanding men, did you get the opportunity to take a unit or platoon?
Well, yes. I think once a term, we all went off for whether it was a week, I think probably a week, very locally, and did some military exercises on the local Surrey Heathlands. And at that time, yes, you would take your turn at being platoon commander or platoon sergeant or section commander, whatever it may have been. But I just wonder the value of that now. We thought it was great, because it got us out into the fresh air and doing what we thought we wanted to do anyway. But I'm thinking of one particular. It only happened once. It was called Infantry Tank Corporation, which again was a great thing, an offshoot from the Second World War. And we were at some blasted heathland near Aldershot somewhere. I think the whole company was there with a troop of tanks. I suspect they were Churchill tanks. And the only method of communication with these tanks was a telephone on the back end. Infantry Tank Corporation, I mean, as far as I can vividly remember, these tanks lurching off across the countryside with us all running like hell behind them. Well, maybe that's what they did in the Second World War in the desert, I don't know. Certainly it wasn't my experience later on, but as I say, there appeared to be no other communication with the tanks. You discussed with them what you were going to do before you started off, and off they went, and off we went on our own flat feet. As an aside, of course, I can imagine just that happening at the great Arras counterattack that you and I visited earlier in the year. That's just what happened, I suspect. The infantry and the tanks might have met before the battle and discussed things, and then off they went. They went that way and we went that way. So, yeah, I just wonder about the validity of the military training. We enjoyed it, but I get a feeling now that it was a bit like playing at soldiers. However, it obviously didn't do us any harm.
Did you do any other training with other arms of the service, Air Force, Navy?
Nope. The Navy, we had a day with the Navy in our senior term. Each senior term used to go off and spend a day with the Navy, and we could opt what bit of the Navy we wanted to go to, and for no particular reason I put down submarines, and so I spent in the Channel. Others went on frigates and so on. But I mean, that was training with them. It was just going for a ride in the Channel. We didn't see anything of the Air Force. The only thing of note, so far as the other, there was Merthyr and Cranmore. There was, if you ever reached the pinnacle of athletic achievement, you would be selected for the Sandhurst team. And there were inter-college events, Merthyr and Cranmore, football, athletics, rugby, and so on. I never reached those dizzy heights. But teams used to go off to Cranmore and play them down to Dartmouth. They would come to Sandhurst and so on. One memorable day, we were on the Academy Square. That's parade ground in front of the old building, the one that you will always see in photographs of Sandhurst. And I don't know what the occasion was. We were practicing for something. The RSM, Mr. Lord, was taking us. And Mr. Lord was a renowned character, revered person. I mean that in the best possible way. The RSM at Sandhurst is, whether he's technically correct or not, he's always regarded as being the senior warrant officer in the British Army. And the tale was, and I had no reason to disbelieve it, that Mr. Lord had been offered, he was a Grenadier Guardsman, he'd been offered his commission and so on. He said, no, I have more influence on the Army as Regimental Sergeant Major at Sandhurst than I would as a Captain Quartermaster in the Grenadier Guards. I can believe that. Anyway, we were on the square, on the Academy Square, and we'd all fallen in, bearing in mind, as I say, there were about 1,000 of us there. And the RSM announced that he would give us until the end of the parade for someone to own up as to who had done it. And we hadn't the faintest idea what he was talking about. And we all stood there. And the parade went on. And from time to time, he would say, remember, gentlemen, I'm waiting. And we still didn't know what he was talking about. And came the end of the parade, and nobody had done anything, said anything, because we really didn't know what he was talking about. And he marches forward. And if you go forward, we were standing with our backs to the building. If you then march forward and you keep going long enough, you end up in the lake. And so off we went, being good soldiers, marching down towards the lake. And he then realized that we really didn't know what he was talking about. So he turned us about and said, look. And again, you're just not thinking about things at that stage of procedure. What had happened was, in front of the old building, there are cannons captured from the French at Waterloo. And there are, I don't know how many there are, let's say there are half a dozen, or probably more than that, spaced out underneath the windows of the old college. And they'd gone. And the RSM naturally thought that we were involved. But apparently what had happened was that Cranmore had been down at Dartmouth playing one of these sports, whatever it was, and they, on their way back, had come up from Dartmouth, and of course the London Road went straight past Camley. They'd come in, and how they'd done it, nobody really understood, because they were in coaches and so on, hitched up these blooming cannons and took them back to Cranmore. And there they were. So, you know, we'd no idea.